Well, good morning. It's just an honor and a pleasure to have you here, Professor Baumann. I hope that in the next days we can be on time and we can start at 10 o'clock. You have been here very nicely before 10, but the audience wasn't that nice. I beg you to be here at 10 o'clock so that we can start on time. Well, for the Chair Ferreter Mora, after so many years of lectures and of seminars, it's simply a great day today that we have here Professor Baumann, one of the most prominent sociologists and thinkers of this time. You are witnesses of our interest in hearing to what he has to tell us. The procedure of this will be the following. I'll explain that now, if you allow me, in Catalan. Avui no hi haurà cap altra sessió un cop acabada la seva exposició. S'acabarà la seva exposició, farem debat i ja estarà. Per als altres dies, a dintre de les carpetes que han rebut, veuran que també hi ha sessions a les 12, que ens les faran els col·legues que acompanyen el professor Baumann i que ens ajudaran a completar. That's why I welcome Professor Kenny and Professor Tester, who have been so friendly as to come here with us. And he will complement, so to speak, the lectures of Professor Baumann so that we can understand and discuss from different points of view the topic, the five topics of this week. This will be from tomorrow on, till Friday. Demà hi haurà una sessió també per a aquells que estiguin interessats en traducció simultània. Aquí ho farem simplement en anglès. Els que després en el debat vulguin intervenir, que no sigui en anglès, que ho facin en un altre idioma, per dir-ho així, és més o menys comprensible, tot i que si ho fan en polonès ell estarà encantat, oi? Però en un idioma comprensible i ho traduiríem, no hi haurà problema. Però demà, a la Mercè, serà amb traducció simultània. Em diuen que està molt, que és planíssim la Mercè ja, però em sembla que estan buscant una manera perquè aquelles persones que estan quedant fora, que no sé si són 200 o no sé quantes, puguin també tenir-hi accés. Per tant, demà podrem concretar-ho això. Serà demà a les 7 de la tarda al Centre Cultural de la Mercè. Quan estàvem comentant amb el professor Baumann la seva vinguda, jo li vaig dir, s'haurien de llegir alguns dels llibres. Quins llibres? Bueno, alguns, clar que s'han de llegir llibres d'ell, oi? Però n'ha escrit tants, oi? Alguns. I ell, amb un correu electrònic, ara no sap que es mantré, oi? Va dir, jo me diu, estaria bé que llegissin, i per tant, per si algú de vosaltres ho ha fet o ho vol fer, Vida de consum, Temps líquids, El tiempo apremia, Daños colaterales. Aquests serien uns quatre, que a ell se li van acudir quan em contestava, que va dir, mira, aquests els hi podrien anar bé a l'audiència per seguir les meves lliçons. Bé, em sembla que amb això he donat totes les pistes que s'han de donar. Cada dia a partir de demà, de 10 a 12, o abans de les 12, perquè farem una petita pausa, i després a les 12 les sessions complementàries dels professors Kenya i Tester. Tota la informació la teniu a dintre de la carpeta, on hi ha també un quadernet explicant, i per això no em sembla que seria innecessari ara que jo expliqués qui és el professor Baumann. Si ho hagués d'explicar ja no seríeu aquí, oi? Okay, I think that everything has been done on my part. That's now your turn, Professor Baumann. Thank you for coming, and I hope that in 5 days we will be able to learn a lot. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, okay, thank you. Thank you very much, Mrs. Peribaros. You were probably raised the expectations, and I would like to put them down again before I start. Thank you very much for coming. It's a beautiful day today, so probably you could find better ways of spending your time. But you came here because you probably expect something. And I suspect that you expect what most of us expect now, and that's a good advice what to do. And because I think that we expect that, I want to warn you that during this week, you won't get much advice what to do. In fact, I believe that all three lecturers in this week will end their lectures. I hope they will be good, particularly in case of the two other lecturers, not me. But they will end up with question mark. That's a paradox. We are sharing probably the feeling that things are getting out of control. What does that mean is that we don't know which direction they are moving. And also that means that even if we knew for sure, with certainty, where to they are moving, we would be pretty unable to do anything really to change their direction. So that is the state which we use the term uncertainty to describe. I think that's the most important feature of contemporary times, that we are living in a situation of permanent, perpetual uncertainty. And when we are, sometimes come to the conclusion that no, the worst already happened, all the elements in the equation whose resolution was uncertain have been already found. When you feel like that, immediately it appears that you learn the hard way that there are more unknowns and more uncertainty than we expected. Now the paradox is that in the times of uncertainty, we need advice. We need advice with consolation, of course. When you get a good advice you can trust, then you are consoled, you feel better. It's not as awful as I expected. But on the other hand, to give advice, and even worse, to pretend that it is a foolproof advice, that you can follow it with closed eyes, that is irresponsible, preposterous, in fact, and certainly premature. So what for we are coming here? I think the only honest answer I can give to it is that you should think together about how we come here, what is the situation really, what are the mechanisms which put it in motion, what are the factors operating there, and therefore start to think, and when you start to think by yourself, then that's the beginning of human freedom. Giving advice which needs to be accepted, conformed to, followed blindly, meekly, is not a good job for human freedom. On the contrary, in history, such a situation when people were convinced that there is somebody could be unhesitatingly trusted, and that there are rules of behavior which should be only followed to bring success. Now, they were very ignominious, unpleasant consequences they used to bring to human life. Anyway, that is in the form of apology. That's why I said it at the beginning, to clear my conscience that we are not here under false pretenses. We can't promise what we can't deliver. Prepare yourself for that. I would I would start from this notion of uncertainty. What does it mean, uncertainty? It's a very common word today, but let's for a moment think, what does it contain? Well, there are several elements in the idea of uncertainty. One element is ignorance. I don't have all the facts. I don't know really. If I only could get more knowledge, then perhaps I won't have this unpleasant feeling of being lost, of things going out of control, and so on. Ignorance, absence of knowledge, absence of firm grounds on which you can base your thinking and your decision making. The other is the feeling of impotence. Impotence, namely that, well, if even someone told me what the best way of proceeding should be, I won't be able to do it. I don't have the power. What I, at the moment, we don't think normally in collective terms. We say what I can do, and I measure myself against the very complicated world which we inhabit and find out that there is no comparison in strength and power between the two, and whatever I do can have very little impact on the situation. So ignorance and impotence, when you take them together, then there is immediately the third element, and the element is humiliation. You feel humiliated, somehow drove to your self-esteem is hurt. Feeling of humiliation is demeaning feeling and offensive to our human pride and our desire to be adequate to the task, to be able to confront it, and to be able to actually go ahead and resolve the difficulty if there is one. So it is a very unpleasant feeling. We react with that to that with outrage. We want to really, contrary to all facts of the matter, we want to do something, we want to try, we want to experiment, and that is already, mind you, a very important moment, very positive moment, because it starts, really passes the whole issue from the area of contemplation, which results in this unpleasant feeling of uncertainty and impotence and being humiliated, and passes from there to the area of action. You want to do something. You want to do something. Well, you have movimiento los indignados. You have Occupy Wall Street. People want to do something. You know what's going on in Turkey, and so on. So it's a time of experimenting, time of trying new ways of doing things, because old ways are clearly not working any longer. Well, I have here sitting Professor Keith Tester in the first row, and he has a very great merit of drawing back from oblivion the concept of interregnum. Interregnum is a very old concept. It goes back to ancient Rome. I think that Tito Livio was the first to use it when he described the beginning, the legendary beginning of Rome. And the concept of interregnum was appropriated, so to speak, by ruling dynasties. It was the brief moment between le roi est mort, vive le roi, change of the ruling persons. But in the modern times, it was picked up again by great Italian philosopher Antonio Gramsci and applied to new situation. In a moment, I'll tell you what this situation was. But originally coined interregnum was a very useful concept because it described situation which in very many respects can be compared to us, in spite of the fact that it's not the question of dynastic problems and change of king. It's a different story which we are referring to when we are using the word interregnum. But nevertheless, the psychological impact on how we receive, how we perceive our human condition is very similar. What's happened in ancient Rome was that the first king of Rome was Romulus. Romulus ruled Rome for 38 years. 38 years, ladies and gentlemen, was the average length of life of the of people at that time, very ancient time. They were not as old as I am. They died much, much younger than that. And therefore, when Romulus died after 38 years of ruling, obviously there were very few Romans who remembered the world which did not contain Romulus. They simply didn't live in such a world, so they had no idea, they had no memory of the times before, but they got used in these 38 years, it's a long time, to the situation in which all instructions, all briefings, or recommendations, or orders were coming from Romulus, whatever it was, palace, or anyway, where he lived, where he had his office. And suddenly he disappeared. And no wonder that the legend which was left after his disappearance was that he didn't die but went straight to heaven. Just to underline, you know, the profound impact of his vanishing. It was not like vanishing of an ordinary person. It was some sort of a earthquake, upheaval, and so on. Anyway, he disappeared, and suddenly, because he was the only source of authority, the only source of authority. Now, authority disappeared together with the source, and people didn't have a valid recommendations how to proceed, how to conduct themselves. Suddenly, and in the future, there was complete uncertainty because there was no established way yet. Romulus was the first king, so there was no established way yet of replacing him. Suspicion was that the old orders have no value, no power already, but there is no one to give the new one, the new orders. And the period between the rule of Romulus and Nemo, his successor, was the first interregnum recorded in this sense, recorded and described. In our own times, the interregnum means simply, as Antonio Gramsci put it, and Professor Kester very beautifully, Kester very beautifully described and elaborated, it was the time when the old is dying and the new cannot be born. Old is dying, new cannot be born. In this interregnum, a great variety of morbid symptoms appear. Now, uncertainty in which we live is one of these morbid symptoms. Well, I put it this way, you know, the old ways of doing things, which seemed to be to the young between you, probably the time when they seemed to be working, is not remembered already, but older people remember that there was a time when we had the sort of trust that most difficult problems have been already resolved and left behind us. We know how to proceed, more of the same, and everything will be good. And even if we were in trouble, there was always always the hope, some hope, underlying certainty, this uncertainty. Certainty that there is somebody who can, we know how to do it. Somebody to improve the situation, and we know roughly how to do it. The last credit collapse, consequences of it, we are still trying, bracing ourselves to embrace, but not with very great success. Unemployment is still rising, people are losing their homes. 50% of Spanish graduates are still looking for jobs, and even more are looking for a job which really is adequate to their skills, to what they actually learn, what they can do. So it was a terrible crisis, and it still is. I don't believe that we see the end of it at the moment. The first reaction to it, people started to compare it to another great crisis written in historical books, because there are not very many people who remember it from personal experience, namely the collapse of stock exchanges, of currencies, by the end of 1920s. There were people who tried to draw conclusions from comparisons and draw some instruction from there, some lesson, what is likely to happen in our time and what we should do in order to find the exit from the mess. Now, there was a mistake in this comparison, because there was one big difference between what happened in Germany, for example, in 1929, and the present situation. The big difference, ladies and gentlemen, was that then in 1920s and later in 1930s, and for the 30 glorious years after the Second World War, the people believed in the state being all-powerful, state. So they could have quarreled tremendously between each other about what needs to be done, but they never asked the question. When I was young, I don't remember this question being asked, who is going to do it? Conviction was that there is a powerful force, which is called state, and the state has the power, ability to do things, and the state has the political means. That means ability to decide which things ought to be done. And having both power and politics, it can do things. It all depends who will win the election, who will be ruling, and the ruler will decide what to do, and once he decides or she decides, that will be done. The reaction, therefore, to the big crisis of 1920s was Keynes, for example, concept of state interfering directly into economy, taking the other control, imposing certain rules, pumping money into it if necessary, restructuring society, remaking reality. Well, in another form, it was done in United States. Roosevelt came to power, New Deal. In Germany, it took the form of people voting a person who exuded certainty and said, give me power and I will do everything okay, and I will just lead you away from the terrible situation in which you are. The same applied to the east of Germany. Well, another totalitarianism, Soviet totalitarianism, also based on the assumption of the omnipresence and omnipotence of the state. It went well after the Second World War. I mentioned briefly 30 glorious wars, years after the Second World War, when the state actually faced, confronted point blank the most painful problems of society, like problems of social inequality, wrong kind of distribution of wealth, the security of individual citizens, security in the sense of providing them good education, good help in the old age, good medical help, and so on, so on. Then somehow this very great power called state began to run out of steam. That happens around at the late 1960s, and particularly came to the fore in 1970s. You know what happened then. Another protest started going away from the state. State cannot, that people found out, it was a mini uncertainty of a sort. They came to the conclusion that mini interregnum, so to speak, that the state cannot any longer deliver on its promises. And they were partly right. The enormity of the tasks which the state took upon itself proved to be overriding its ability to act, particularly because that was a time of the already advancing from behind the scene, invisibly, globalization. Why I am saying advancing from behind the scene, invisibly? Because at that time, if you remember, the world was divided into two camps, and you know, it was not just the question of Berlin Wall, which stopped German citizens from the east going to the west, but it was also the curtain which somehow prevented us from seeing the underlying processes going on in the world, processes of globalization, processes of power emanating, just vanishing, evaporating, leaking from the hands of the nation state, becoming supranational. That's exactly what we see now very clearly. Much of the power which was held monopolistically by the state went away, and it roams now in the so-called cyberspace, or as the great Spanish sociologist Manuel Castells says, space of flows. Space of flows where, well, everything is liquid. Liquid, and try to catch liquid, you won't succeed. You know, it goes through your fingers. It's not, you are just the old ways of catching reality by throat do not work very well. So the process of globalization went to the situation surreptitiously, I repeat, surreptitiously, when the promises of providing collective insurance to every individual citizen of the state could not be any longer held. That was turned against the institutions of so-called welfare state. I prefer to call it social state. I think for some reason it's a better concept than welfare state. But nevertheless, accusations, charges were made against that. It is clumsy, it is heavy, it is not delivering properly, it is very costly, bureaucratic, and so on and so on. Not to bring to the agenda, not to make obvious the process which was behind it. Behind it was the process of what Kenneth Galbraith, the great economist, American economist, described as the secession of the contended, secession of the contended. Elite lost their interest in local labor. As simple as that, no longer. Once you have globalization, the financial elite, people who are well off, people who are able, they are very nicely called by, in the language of stock exchanges, the investors, but they, in fact they are people making profits, right, out of all this process. Now, there is simply, contrary to previous situation, felt emancipated from the obligation to the local community, to the local labor, and so on. I always use in this context a very good example of the accomplishment of Henry Ford, the senior, not only a very successful businessman, but also a very witty man. And what he did at some point, he doubled the wages of his workers. Created an outrage in public opinion of America, because the whole trend then was cutting down wages and just exploiting more and more deeply the local labor. He was asked, "Why have you done it, Mr. Ford?" By hordes of journalists which pestered him. And his answer was very witty. He said that I did it because I wanted my workers to buy my cars. Well, it was a joke, obviously, because how many cars they could buy, and but doubling their wages, of course, increased the cost of production very strongly. But what in fact was behind it? Is that Henry Ford, better than very many other robber businessmen in America, understood the situation. He understood that the dependency between him and his labor is mutual. Not only his workers are dependent on Mr. Ford for their livelihood, but Mr. Ford is dependent on his workers for his wealth. He can't, like the contemporary businessman, pack up the iPad, you know, or a tablet, it is called now, laptop, it was called 2 or 3 years ago, but, you know, the concept changed very quickly. Just pack up that and send his capitals to, I don't know where to Bangladesh or to South Africa, and simply disappear. The mutual, the reciprocal dependency has been because of the secession of the contenders, secession of the successful, has been unilaterally cancelled. Labor was left behind. They have had to stew in their own juice. But the capital could, at any moment, just pack up and go away. Something, a luxury, which was not available to Henry Ford. And that's why Henry Ford said just that. That's why he really doubled his labor. He wanted to bribe them. He wanted to keep them. He didn't want to lose them to General Motors. They were trained. They were already used to certain routines, and they were needed. If the good sense of Henry Ford, if he wanted to be richer than he was, and obviously he wanted, was to keep them, because of the mutuality of dependency. But now, I quote Manuel Castells again, there are two different spaces which do not communicate very well with each other. One is the space of flows, and the other is the space of places. Something like 90% of humanity is confined in the space of places, tied down to the ground. Some more most adventurous, more courageous between them, risk death in illegal navigation through sea, and try to get where the bread and butter and job and drinking water can be, is available, but follow their bosses who run away simply. But for most of people, that's not available. So among those people, ladies and gentlemen, for whom it is not available, are our governors, prime ministers, ministers, governments. They also cannot move. They are tied to the ground, the same way as abandoned labor, for different reasons. Of course, if they wanted to go for holiday, they would be welcomed at that carpet and so on. But if they wanted to become prime ministers and practice their profession elsewhere, of course, they wouldn't be able to do so. So they are also tied to the ground. That is the problem. Problem which I call as the divorce between power and politics. Divorce between power and politics. Power and politics lived in the same household for several centuries. For several centuries, last centuries. Power, I repeat again, power is the ability to have things done. And politics is the ability to decide which things ought to be done. Now, both these elementary ingredients of effective action were in the hands of the state. Now, when we witness the divorce, it is no longer the case. I repeat, power evaporates more and more from the state, but states are tied to the ground. Power, ladies and gentlemen, particularly the very powerful power, the decisive power, is already global. But politics is, as it was 300 years ago, local. Now there is a discrepancy. The political institutions which we have at our disposal cannot match the grandiosity of the task. They simply cannot submit the global powers to their control. Well, if you want to know, by latest statistics, 1/3 of the global produce is already made by supranational, multinational companies, which do not swear allegiance to any particular place, which can move around. 1/3 of the produce and 2/3 of the trade, global trade, is made by the same supranational corporations. And we haven't even started in earnest, the process of matching the riches, the volume of our political means of action with the volume, with the extension of the power. Well, that is underneath what Professor Tester reminded us to is the situation of interregnum. Old ways of doing things which were tested are no longer effective. But the new ones do not exist. The old ways, I repeat, were the ways of acting through the state. State had all the instruments necessary to make the action undertaken effective. That was the old ways. New ways, which are still in the on the drawing board, they haven't been put in practice yet. Need to be, means which are equal in scale, in greatness, so to speak, to the ways operated by the multinational power, multinational, supranational, global powers. So, to return for a moment to the question I asked before, what is the difference between the present crisis and the 1920s crisis? Why the comparison is not called for, is misleading. I brought the story to 1970s, when the idea was that, the state cannot deliver any longer. But fortunately, we can read again Adam Smith, and learn from him that it is thanks to the greed that we have a daily bread, and therefore there is a market. Let us privatize, which was previously in the hands of the market, of the state. Let us deregulate what was previously regulated, for example, the labor markets, the condition of employment, the stability of jobs and things like that. Let us deregulate that. Let us contract out. That's the new technical term, the functions which were performed with obligation, sometimes even jealously guarded obligation of the state. Let us contract them out to private companies. Let's have, private prisons, private police, private whatever, private hospitals, of course, and so on and so on. And everything will be okay. The invisible hand of the market will do what the ostensibly wise men sitting in parliaments and in governments could not. Bureaucrats spoiled the job. Market will put it on the right track. That was the lucky situation of people who went through 1970s crisis. The lucky situation of people who went through the crisis in 1920s was that they still believed in state. And the lucky situation of the people who went through 1970 crisis was that they believed in market. Today, we don't believe in either. That's a trouble. And that's why this crisis is unlike previous crises. We are clearly on some sort of a watershed. A new situation is emerging, completely new, and we really don't have the ground rules. We don't have any learned routines. How to respond to the present day situation. That's a trouble. I would call the present crisis of agency. Agency is the, whatever it is, single, several, collective instrument which is able to act effectively. That's agency, roughly. Now, crisis of agency means that the major question today, unlike in my very, very distant youth time, is not any longer what is to be done. The most difficult question is who is going to do it? Who is going to do it? We can't say, like our ancestors in 1920 said, of course, the state, and we can't say, like our predecessors in 1970s said, of course, the market, because neither market nor the state are very reliable. We have seen it very clearly what the consequences of deregulated, contracted out, outsourced institutions of the market, what mess they have produced. The tremendous collapse of credit. credit is what the secret of this fairy tale story of consumerist orgy which we lived through until 2007. That was it's a good name for that, consumerist orgy. It was an orgy, because how do you recognize that something was an orgy? Normally you recognize it only on the morning after, what Germans called Katzenjammer. Then you wake up suddenly, you have awful feeling, and then you know that what was yesterday was not a ball, but it was an orgy. And that was consumerist orgy based on, in fact, on very simple stratagem, expedient, invented, discovered by the banks. Namely, that people who are not in debt, who don't borrow money, who don't repay the interest on money, are of no use, of no worth whatsoever to the banking system. If only people who live by saving book, they wanted to save the money in order to buy the object of their dreams later on when they collect the money. If they are persuaded, convinced, to move from the culture of saving book to the culture of credit card, that will be tremendously prolific source of income, really. Just imagine all these millions of people who were saving every penny in order to buy 5 years.
May I put myself a question, and so we'll start. In that situation, what does it mean, democracy?
What
does it mean, democracy? And why do we still vote every 4 years? Does it have a meaning at all in the interregnum?
As Americans would say, you know, it's a $64,000 question. what's the future of democracy? You know as well as I do that people have very much debt on their mind, and all sorts of proposals are voiced. Not one of them is generally accepted. They die these propositions in very early stage simply by confronting a very powerful opposition and so on. I am in a better situation. I'm not a prophet. I can't predict how it will work. I only think that if Aristotle, who actually is credited to have coined the idea of democracy, the concept of democracy, if he was invited to Madrid or to Barcelona to the session of the local parliament, he would probably like it, because people present ideas, quarrel, argue, and so on. He would be in his element, really. But if you told him after that, you were witness to democracy, he would laugh, because what he understood by democracy was very different fish from what's going on in the parliaments in Britain or in Spain or in any other place. The very idea of representational democracy would be completely incomprehensible to him. Democracy is when people actually take things into their own hands. How can you delegate someone else to represent you? This sort of thing. That wouldn't be comprehensible. We are very much in the same situation, I am quite sure, because I am generally speaking men with hopes. I'm hoping. I'm not optimist, I am not pessimist, but I'm hoping. And I hope that Humans can be trusted that from every successive crisis, and there were so many of them in history, they will find an exit. The only question is whether it will be easy exit or very costly exit, very many victims, very gory, you know, and things like that. But finally, they will find. Democracy has to be re-established, or rather reinvented on the global level, where the powers are. We haven't any kind of democracy, even the beginnings, even the incipient signs of it on the global level so far. You can't confuse interministerial or intergovernmental occasional meetings with democracy. That's nothing to do with democracy. As you know, I will have a lecture, a special lecture about Europe. Europe is accused that it's built without any democratic support from the bottom, and so on and so on. So, first, my prediction under these limited circumstances is that some sort of an equivalent of institutions which our ancestors invented and put in place for one state democracy will be created, invented for one planet democracy. But the second part of my prediction is that in their form, they won't remind you of the democracy centered in Madrid or London or Warsaw or any other place. Different form, different kind. I was present several years ago with Professor Galtung, very, very knowledgeable political scientist, not only political scientist, but also political practitioner. So he's much better than I, because he is engaged both in theorizing and in doing politics. And he was asked the question, what are the chances of the World Parliament? His answer was like that. I repeat for memory. He was Norwegian. He is Norwegian, so he started in Norvegia. He said, let's imagine we have a planetary parliament. There are two Norwegians sitting, there are 10 Italians, 15 Germans, 1,000 Chinese. And he stopped, looked around and said, I don't see much enthusiasm for the planetary parliament. So, you see, that's the problem. If we are to have some sort of institutions which will represent and put together and try to synthesize, try to argue the diverse interests of the planet, it cannot be parliament only bigger. It can't be a government only bigger. By the way, Karl Jaspers, the great German philosopher, reasoned about the future of the world after the disaster of the Second World War, and he said that what he fears most is the world government. That would be the worst kind of totalitarianism in history. Why? Because there will be nowhere to escape. She was right. it can't be like that. It must be different. In the same way as our parliaments differ from market democracy in the case of Aristotle. So that, unfortunately, as far as I can go. Terribly sorry. But I warned you in the beginning that I won't bring solutions, I only put questions.
You want to add something to that? You want to add something? Do. No?
No, let's give a chance to the audience to ask the questions.
But you belong to the audience. Okay, you said that the lack of leadership among the movements, the movements that exist now, they are going to be dumb because of that. The lack of leadership. The lack of leadership, you said in your lecture.
Yes.
That's going to condemn the movement. You talk about the Wall Street movement. So it's going to be a different thing, like assembly kind of discussions, things like that. I don't know. I mean, what do you see?
What's your question?
The question is that you don't believe in those movements because they don't have leaders.
Yeah.
So you said they don't have leaders, they don't have ideas, so they are condemned.
Is that better then? Right. I've just had that question deftly passed to me, haven't I? So perhaps if I have a roundabout sort of answer to the question, taking up the initial point about democracy and why do we vote and the idea of a world government. I think I'd just like to make a number of observations, really. The issue of why do we vote? Well, do we? I mean, you know, just at an empirical level, the amount of voting or the voting rate is in, you know, a very pronounced process of decline. So that's the first thing. Secondly, this question of world government. Whenever I hear the phrase world government, what always comes to my mind is an essay that George Orwell wrote. It was an essay he wrote about H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells, the English science fiction writer, was a great proponent of world government. Wells saw this as the answer to war. It would be a way of building global peace, prosperity, and happiness. World government for Wells was wonderful. George Orwell, on Saturday I was in Barcelona and took a photograph of George Orwell, which is wondrous. He wrote an essay about H.G. Wells, and the essay goes on. It's just saying, you know, well, H.G. Wells has got this idea. It's marvellous. It's brilliant. Will this lead to global peace? Quite possibly. Will it lead to prosperity? Quite possibly. Then the essay just ends, and it ends with the comment that the idea of world government, everyone can agree with this. Who's going to do it? Who is going to bring about this world government? The people of goodwill haven't got the power, and the people with the power haven't got the goodwill. End. So there's that question of world government. And also, whilst Professor Bauman was talking, an idea floated across my mind. Do we actually already have the world government? Quite possibly it exists. It's just not the kind that any of us ever thought it would be. It's not a democratic world government. It's a world government, well, it's a world oligarchy. This makes me sound like a conspiracy theorist, so forgive me. But it's a corporate world, a corporatist state world government, where local working classes are completely irrelevant. They're just a problem to be controlled from the point of view of the global elite. So I wonder if, secondly, we already have the world government, it's just not the one we wanted, or not the one that was expected, predicted, except for one or two people who we don't talk about anymore. In the UK, I teach sociology. One of the names we never use anymore is Marx, or very rarely. Perhaps there's time to redo that. The Occupy movement, these are just random thoughts. When the Occupy movement was at its peak. There were a number of Occupy camps in London as well. There was one in a square, I've forgotten which square it is, near the city. There was another Occupy camp around by St. Paul's Cathedral. St. Paul's Cathedral is the centrepiece of the British establishment. St. Paul's Cathedral is one of the main seats of the Church of England, which has heavy investment in capitalist enterprises. St. Paul's Cathedral is, that's the point where Mammon and God virtually become indistinguishable. What struck me about the Occupy movements was just the very notion of Occupy. And it was quite clear, actually just looking at the camps, the camps were there in a specific place. But then what happened? Nothing. They weren't about anything. They were about occupying the space. And that was it. They weren't. The whole notion of occupy means we are here, remember us. It's not actually about going anywhere or doing anything. And whilst I'm not saying that political movements need leaders with a vision, I'm not saying that at all. What I am saying is I think the Occupy movement ended up in a state of paralysis because once it has occupied, there is nothing else for it to be about other than repeating the statement, we are here, we are here. And as Professor Bauman said, the Occupy Wall Street movement, I mean, there's lots of books about it and so forth. Where did it have no impact at all? On Wall Street. Similarly, St. Paul's Cathedral, the Occupy camps ended up, they did a deal with the police. So here we have a social protest against the system, which then did a deal with the local authorities and the police forces. We will have our camp round the side of the cathedral so no one notices it if they don't really want to. And it became like a tourist site, a fairly untidy one as well. So this question of democracy then, I'm inclined to think this is part of the interregnum. The old is dying, the old forms of democracy are dying, I think. Possibly new forms are emerging, but they're not democratic in the way that we would expect or did expect or at all would desire. But thirdly then, the new has not yet been born. I think the Occupy movement was a great moment of, it was a statement of intent. Yes, we need a new form of politics. But it had nowhere to go other than to occupy the spaces which it occupied. And then they ended up as tourist sites. Yeah. They were one more thing to tick off. I was asked to go to one and just collect some leaflets for someone, take a few photographs if I had the chance on my phone. That was it. They became tourist things. So I think that this question of democracy, it remains. We're going in two ways. One, as I say, I think it might already exist, but it's not what we recognise as democracy. Secondly, it remains to be made. And the resources of the making it, I'm not sure where they are or if they will be.
Do you want to say something?
If I can come back to the notion of democracy, and I would like to recall the ancient Greek or Aristotelian concept of democracy. It meant in Aristotelian typology of various rules, he distinguished democracy as aristocracy, which meant the ruling of the few, tyranny as the rule of the one, ochlocracy as the rule of the mob, uneducated and just not not prepared to rule from democracy, which was meant as a rule of all citizens. Well, it was all citizens were, of course, male and adult only, but the principles of democracy, he distinguished the few main principles of democracy. It was freedom and equality. It was the rule of the free people. Everyone could control his own or her own life, his own life, to decide what propose what he wants, and equality was meant that their
voice given to everybody.
Yes, that the voice is given to everybody. And in the later development, democracy wasn't anymore the direct participation of all citizens, or equal and free citizens in making decisions. Professor Baumann already mentioned that this representative became just the way of electing from time to time, every 4 or 5 years, representatives. The control over their decision is diminishing, and by the end of the former century there was enthusiasm about several waves of democratization going on in the world. The beginning of the 21st century was accompanied with the growing disappointment with democracy, and paradoxically it is worse in those countries which are perceived as having the greatest achievement in democratization. People are more and more dissatisfied, the feeling of the crisis of democracy is growing the participation in voting diminishes, particularly in diminishes when it comes to the election to European Parliament, where the participation is very low. Now we are seeing that this crisis is accompanied by the conflict and division of the political forces that are trying to emphasize either the freedom side of democracy or the equality side, and there are two types of political ideologies. One is that is emphasizing the freedom is called liberalism or neoliberalism, and the other that emphasizes power and unity of the and equality of the people is called populism or neo-populism. At least in my country, in Poland, but I believe it's also going on in many other Latin America, in other parts of the world, is this kind of a conflicts, ideological conflicts and clashes between this neo-populist and neoliberal forces. And well, whenever they are able to have some charismatic leaders, and of course, populist movements usually can more easily produce a charismatic leader who appeals directly to the people and is saying that he has this feeling of being of the people and able to talk with people. Emphasizing the unity of the people usually means also the intolerance toward all those who are not the same as this leader's notion of what is the basis of the unity of the people. So people of other nationality or other orientation there is a tendency to exclude them. This clashes, political clashes, usually results in the situation when the elections are just choosing those who didn't govern the former time, and they're looking for the other side, but so the opposition comes to power and then being unable, as Professor Bauman said, being deprived of the power to of the ability to get things done, just gives during the next election the other side comes to power and so on. And it's growing feeling among people that there is no one for whom they can vote. This is also some kind of the crisis of leadership and lack of leadership, because people get disappointed because the governors cannot get things done, cannot keep their promises. The solution, I think that all these movements are experimenting, are trying to find some solution. And usually they succeed in turning, in getting rid of some rulers. But there is very little, there are of course also many experiments how to construct the life from the bottom. Some small corporations, local communities that are trying to create some ways of solution, but they cannot solve the global problems. So that's the. All the symptoms of this interregnum and looking for the new ways of ruling and awareness of that the old ones do not work anymore.
Precisely that. That's a very important point, because up to now, in our classical form of democracy, there was a crucial point, namely the voters or the opposition could remove the former rulers. If you now come to the idea that the real rulers cannot be removed at all, there is no possibility, even if you change government, etc., but the rulers cannot be removed, then everything is hopeless. If they cannot be removed, that's my question. If they cannot be removed, then...
Some of them go bankrupt, but the other just, get richer.
But the population, those who are going, who vote, the workers, the normal people, not investors, not these people, when they go every 4 years voting, then what happens? Even if they change the government, they don't change the rulers. That's my point. They don't change the system.
I think, though, there are...
Please, close to the microphone.
Sorry. I think, I mean, whilst changing the rulers, we might want to debate that more as the week goes on. There is, however, some... Voting still does have an importance. And I think, I mean, one of the things I'm going to be talking about in my sessions is I'm going to try to reflect on what's been going on in Britain. And I think here, Britain is an example of why voting actually does or can make a difference. I mean, I don't want to stand on a political platform. Do I? I don't know. Maybe I do. I certainly don't want any power anyway, and I don't deserve it. But voting does make... I mean, at the moment, we have in Britain a government which is very well accommodated with power, with global corporate power. And this has led to the deliberate destruction of what remained of the welfare state. I think their voting does make a difference. I'm not saying that a different government would have done anything different, but certainly the rhetoric would have been less cruel, less divisive, and frankly, in many places, less fascistic as well. I mean, I think one of the dangers also of this kind of, well, I suppose we can use the phrase democratic deficit, is that you get political leaders emerge whose power is precisely the fact that they treat the whole process as a joke. And I think this is dangerous. So in Italy, Berlusconi was the first wave of that. I mean, with far better intentions. Grillo, is it, in Italy? In the Italian elections last year, there was that political movement where vote for us and we will resign. In Britain, we've got, you might have heard of it, the UK Independence Party, which is led by a man called Nigel Farage. His selling point is precisely that he is absurd. That is the point. His policy is that Britain should withdraw from the European Union. Okay? And that's the answer to any issue whatsoever, anything. So what's the answer to better schooling in England? We withdraw from the European Union. What's the answer to increasing queues in accident and emergency at hospitals? Britain withdraws from the European Union. That's the answer to everything. But his whole point is that he is absurd and he presents himself as almost ludicrous and as a caricature. In this sense that voting doesn't make any difference, voting really doesn't matter, people like figures like that can emerge, and actually I think they're incredibly dangerous. So the problem with voting is, at one level, it doesn't make any... I really don't think it does make any difference. But at another level, it makes a huge amount of difference, and that's what we need to try to think through and try to work out some way of conceptualizing, I think.
Well, I would like just to add that I completely agree with you that the voting does make difference because, well, the other, I lived through the times when the only ways of getting rid of the former governors was mass violence, or killing them, or waiting until they will die. And then it was the only way of changing system, which was known in this country as well.
Only comment, my predecessor explained it all and better did it than I could. I want only on that one element here to what emerged in the consequence of the question asked by Professor Terribaras, that it is not only crisis of trust in a particular political movement or a political specific political party, but in the institution of democracy, the democratically elected government as such. And if you ask why it's so happening, the answer is that each government, because of the situation which does not depend on any particular government, but is a global in its roots, cannot deliver on its promises. And therefore, I suggest to you that no longer the positive idea of a society, good society, which you would like to introduce, but frustration is the major factor in changing political parties, changing governments. Normally, people elect, if they go to voting, they still would agree with Professor Tester, they should go to voting, but it's only to react to frustration which the presently governing team brought them. Not because they have a fully formed idea of a better society they want to introduce. And why we stopped thinking about a good society? Simply because of this big question, who is going to do it? As long as people believe that there was a power in the form of state, which is able to remake society. All right, they quarrel tremendously what good society should be like. But now what for you are wasting? You would waste your time. You are just voting against the existing government in order to bring somebody to clean the mess with the old government left. I am even risking, ladies and gentlemen, suggesting that if Monsieur Hollande was president of France during the economic crisis, credit collapse, we would have president of France Sarkozy today. And if Monsieur Rajoy was prime minister during the economic crisis, we would have Mr. Zapatero today as a prime minister. So there was no move to the left in case of France, no move to the right in case of Spain. It was simply frustration with the existing government which didn't deliver on their own promise. And that's a crisis of democracy.
Well, thanks. That's more a comment than a question and a comment.
A comment.
Slight disagreement with what Tester said at first about. I may agree that these Occupy movements, as you call them, in New York or London, may have led to nothing or just weak outcomes. But I think that if we change perspective and we take as the model the movements that occurred in the Mediterranean shore, I think the picture is slightly different. Because I think that the actual numbers of people that followed the movements are much more different or are much more significant than those that followed the movements in the Anglo-American countries, I would say, because there, as far as I know, the movements were more broadcasted than actually joined, that actually followed. And I would say that, as far as I know, for example, in here or in other countries in the Mediterranean shore, some things have changed. Governance have changed. The social impact of these movements, at least here in here, can be actually perceived. People engaged in different ways of doing things, new forms of sociability and new ways of organizing things have arisen, and people engaged in them. So I think your picture was a bit pessimistic because you took you got the perspective, like the Anglo, I would say, centric perspective, but if you change it, maybe things can be seen differently.
Thank you. I'm sure the three of you are aware of the many independency processes that are taking place in the world at this moment. My question is that if you think that these want to be states, if you regard them as an opportunity to reinvent democracy, the topic which we've been talking about.
That's a possibility of reinventing by then a new way of democracy. Not just independence, but...
Council of Europe.
Yes.
What do you think about that?
Look, there is a European Union consists of two institutions. One is European Council, which is politics without policy, and the other is Brussels, which is policy without politics. But, you know, what are you asking about? It's a very complex story. Look, I have this special lecture. If you are interested, whoever is interested in my modest opinion about it, is invited tomorrow, really. I don't want to preempt what I'm going to say tomorrow about Europe. Europe will be the topic tomorrow evening.
There is a hope that the new countries, the new independent movements will help to find out the new ways of solving the problems of democracy. Of course, we did witness many such movements before, and Slovakia separating from Slovakia, Czechs from Czechoslovakia, it was a positive example. It was even called the velvet divorce, though not everybody was satisfied. Slovaks were more satisfied, but then they for some time were doing much worse than before. The negative example was, of course, this collapse of the former Yugoslavia, and it resulted in the wars and ethnic cleansing. Some richer former republics are doing better and. Of course, well, there is always some hope that the independent movements will bring some new solutions of the problems, but sometimes the solutions are well, not necessarily only positive. It can lead to some very dangerous result as well. Yes.
10 o'clock in the morning, 10 the first session, at 12 the second one, in the evening